Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Yuri Friedman, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers global affairs. He was previously the deputy managing editor at Foreign Policy, and his latest article at The Atlantic is France's political crisis just beginning? Welcome to Background Briefing, Yuri Friedman.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. And France dodged a bullet. The EU sighed a great sigh of relief. Angela Merkel is obviously happy that the worst didn't happen in terms of the further unraveling of the EU following Brexit. But as you point out, this young new leader of France, Emmanuel Macron, doesn't really have a party. The two main parties, in many ways, like the two main parties over here. In our last election, Donald Trump is hardly a Republican, and one of the leading candidates on the Democratic side was a socialist. So let's start with that premise. How much have the main parties in France all but disappeared?
What's happened in this election cycle is really astounding. Never before in the history of the French Fifth Republic, which started in 1958, has the second round of the presidential election not featured a representative from either the main left-wing party or the main right-wing party. So it's a bit roughly different systems, but roughly like, you know, the Republicans and Democratic Party main candidates not making it past the primaries. You had a far-right nationalist candidate against someone who created their political movement last year. And so I think this really was, in a lot of ways, a rejection of the political establishment, no matter which candidate you chose. You know, a lot of mainstream politicians in France have been praising the fact that Macron won and congratulating him, but he is far from, a entrenched member of the political establishment. He certainly served in government. He went to top schools. He was an investment banker. But in terms of his stature within the political establishment, he is kind of a newcomer, and that is a major rejection. I think it reflects something really critical about the mood of the French electorate right now, which is that there's a lot of disillusionment with politics. You know, 70% of French voters say they don't have confidence in government right now. I think you saw that in the results on Sunday.
But is there the ability to, is there a kind of a patronage system in France like there is in most countries? I mean, for example, Donald Trump is going to be in an unusual situation where he's got more federal judges he can appoint than just about any of his predecessors. And he's about to start doing that. And we know that he doesn't like a lot of the judges that have ruled against him so far. Mm-hmm. So that's just an example of a patronage system, if you will. But how powerful is the French civil service? In other words, if this guy doesn't have a political infrastructure, is there one that he can co-opt?
Yes, I think there is. There are ways that he can kind of build up a political infrastructure and political organization very quickly. So, for example, he has said he is going to have a candidate run under his banner, his political movement, in every one of France's electoral districts. And this is for the upcoming parliamentary elections in June. France always has a presidential election, and then a little while later they have a parliamentary election. And the idea traditionally has been, you know, you elect someone to the presidency, and then on their coattails, that party wins a majority in parliament, and they can kind of govern. They appoint a prime minister, and they can govern with undivided government. There's questions now about whether Macron can do that because his political movement is so new. But what you're probably going to see is some socialist and Republican politicians kind of run under his banner, so kind of jump over to his side since he has all the political momentum. And even if he doesn't, the French voters are typically don't like undivided government. They want the government to function well and smoothly and efficiently. And so I think you will see a lot of people under this new on the move movement be elected into the legislature. And so he will be able to build an organization from the ground up and support in the legislature very quickly. And beyond that, I think there is an ability for him, once he has the levers of government, to implement a number of his policies. Where I think he will find the most obstruction is in some of his most ambitious reform policies. For example, loosening French labor laws, because right now it's hard to hire, fire, and negotiate with workers. He also wants to cut government spending, implement tax cuts. These are things that have been tried by past leaders and not worked. And now he doesn't have the traditional party structure that other leaders have had. So I think he's going to run into a lot of difficulty there, but he might be able to do it.
Now, on the eve of the election, of course, there was this massive data dump from hacking, which has been attributed to Fancy Bear, a part of the Russian military intelligence, the GRU. Those are the people that hacked into the DNC and to John Podesta. So there are hearings today, of course, with Sally Yates and the former DNI General Clapper. Questions are being asked about France and in the context of what happened in America. The hearings are about Russia itself and where to go forward and to prevent Russia from doing what it has succeeded in doing in interfering in the American election and just having interfered in the French election. Is there likely to be a backlash, a blowback from this? I'm astounded that more Americans aren't annoyed or angry or indignant about Russians interfering or Putin interfering in our elections here. The Republicans, for reasons which seem fairly nakedly partisan, don't seem to think it's a big deal that they helped elect Trump. But I get the impression the French are a little more peeved.
Yeah, I think one thing that's been striking is how muted the response was in France. I think there are a few different reasons for this. One was the leaks happened on Friday, just before midnight. And in France, you know, after midnight on Friday, going into the election on Sunday, there's a media blackout. So the media can't really talk about the election. The candidates themselves can't talk about the election. On the one hand, you could say maybe these leaks of emails from the Macron campaign were timed specifically for that purpose, so that they would go right into the blackout and no one would be able to talk about them except on social media, where there would be like a, you know, a spin cycle of speculation. And so that could have been among the motivations of the leakers. On the other hand, what it did is it also muted the conversation in the mass media among the politicians. It wasn't like Marine Le Pen could, you know, find some juicy tidbit in the leaks and then publicize it on the campaign trail. And so I think that was one reason why the response was so muted. I think there was also something even more banal. There just wasn't so much that was very interesting in those leaks. From what we know so far, from anything that's been discussed, it's not like there was anything scandalous. And I think that also played a role in it not getting much attention. And I think beyond that, there has been some lessons learned from the U.S. campaign about the fact that discussing these leaks can be as powerful as the leaks themselves, in that it can change the course of these leaks don't work in terms of altering political outcomes unless they are discussed and dissected and widely disseminated. And that did not happen. I think those, you know, I'm sure there were many French voters and French media outlets and French politicians who said, we're not going to play this game again. And one thing to clarify is we really don't know yet who was behind these leaks. It wasn't WikiLeaks publicized it, but it wasn't published through WikiLeaks. It was done online through an anonymous posting site called Pastebin. There's some suspicions among some cybersecurity firms that the same Russian hackers are behind this, but we don't know for sure. Whatever the case, it is pretty clear that the goal was to interfere in the election. And so whether it was Russia or independent non-state actors, this is just happening more and more. The people think they can influence elections by hacking. And we need to. And what France kind of showed, even more than the U.S. perhaps, because it was more experienced in these matters after the U.S. election, is how do we as free democratic societies respond to these leaks? What's the best way to do that? I think they provided a pretty strong example on Sunday.
But in the broader sense, surely Putin lost, even if there's not the indignation that I'm surprised isn't more intense over here. And it's pretty shameful, I think, that the Republicans, who normally were not particularly friendly towards the Soviet Union during the Cold War, are suddenly making apologies for Putin. And even in some cases, like Dana Rohrabacher and others, basically, you know, supporting him along with Donald Trump, up until lately, shall we say. But prior to the elections, it was pretty clear. Le Pen was over there meeting with Putin. No question about her ties to him. Fillon was quite sympathetic, had business ties to some of Putin's cronies. Mélenchon, the far-left guy, he was a supporter of Putin's. So the only person in the running that wasn't close to Putin won. So is that a rebuke?
I think officials in the Kremlin, including Vladimir Putin, were not super happy with the result today, on Sunday. I think they would not have preferred Macron. He certainly was the least favorable candidate to them. And the suspicions of Russian involvement in this latest hack are only going to harden Macron's attitude towards Russia, whether or not it bears out that it was the Russian government that was behind this. I think Fillon or Le Pen would have been much more preferable candidates. Their policies aligned with what the Kremlin wants. But I think that, the Russian government is going to have to work with Macron, and they kind of acknowledge that in their statement after the election, saying we want to dispel mutual distrust and work together on terrorism. Now, that's pretty rich, considering that they met with Le Pen during the election. Who knows how Macron's government is going to take that. But I think this was a blow to what they would have wanted to see in the region. I think the election of Donald Trump, to be honest, is also not necessarily working out according to the way they might have thought it would. Right after the election, there was a lot of euphoria in Moscow about the fact that this would be a new era in U.S.-Russian relations. And what we're seeing right now is that has stalled. There is not a lot of signs of real progress. The Trump and Putin had a phone call the other day, and there was talk of a possible meeting. Maybe they'll meet, but there has not been a kind of renaissance of U.S.-Russian relations, a crusade to fight terrorism and get along great that people might have expected right after the election.
But in these hearings today, co-chaired by Lindsey Graham and Sheldon Whitehouse, a lot of what they're saying, and General Clapper reiterated this, is we're learning about what the Russians are up to in terms of manipulating our elections and the French elections and earlier the Dutch elections and then the upcoming German elections. And the lessons learned are meant to prevent it, and we got to figure out ways to prevent it next time around. And Lindsey Graham hinted that we got to get tough with the Russians, otherwise they'll keep doing it because they've been successful so far. Now, Angela Merkel met just a few days ago in Sochi with Putin, and they talked a lot about this interference as well, I understand. What is the problem that the Europeans have with getting tough with Russia? My understanding is it's because of Gazprom, their dependence on Russian gas, and is that the explanation, or are there things that the Russians can do, just as Lindsey Graham hinted today in the hearings, that America should do in terms of getting tough against the Russians screwing with their elections?
Yeah, I think you're totally right that energy supplies is a big reason why Europe has always been ambivalent about taking too tough a position with the Russians. On the other hand, they have some incentive to do it because Russia is, their neighbor. And Russian actions in Ukraine, for example, have raised concerns that that kind of situation could happen in Baltic countries, which are part of NATO. I would say Europe is both more ambivalent because of their dependency on gas energy supplies and also more urgently involved in this issue than America is, because America's, separated by the Atlantic Ocean. Europe is dealing with this right on in their neighborhood. I think there are certain things that Europe and the United States can do. One that I found was very interesting is that there's been the head of the digital operations for Macron's campaign said that when they found out that there were all these cyber attacks against their campaign, they actually tried to send them all this false information. And they actually used cyber techniques to retaliate against the hackers, whoever they were. I think that's a really interesting model, which is that if we know these things are inevitable, whether or not they're being directed by a government or a non-government actor, how can we create better cyber defenses and actually fool these folks? If we know it's going to happen, how can campaigns and political operations get more savvy? Beyond that, I think there is a real question right now about what is proper retaliation for these kinds of interference in our democratic processes. So what you saw with the Obama administration is a real belated response. And then when they did respond, they kicked out some diplomats, they imposed sanctions. And I think there is a question of whether that really had a deterrent effect. Would something more swift have made a bigger difference? Would taking means that were more aggressive have made a difference. And I think we have not seen that in the case of France, because there's really the attribution isn't there. The attribution that we had in the U.S. election by the intelligence agencies was much more conclusive than what we've seen so far from the French election. But I think there is an open debate right now that about what is the proper response. And I think what governments like Russia or non-state actors are exploiting right now is that these societies don't have great responses. And so they know that these societies are vulnerable to this kind of interference because people don't know exactly how to respond. So I think that is one of the big tasks ahead. If the U.S. election and the French election and all these European elections have proven anything, it's that these societies and the people in these societies need to have a debate and come up with some, you know, actual concrete plans for when this occurs, because it's going to occur. It's only going to occur more. How do societies respond, and how do they deter it from happening? And I think we don't have concrete answers there yet.
Well, when you talk about Obama's response to the hacking, that's key to the hearings today, of course, because Sally Yates was talking about General Flynn and what they knew about him and from the intercepts with his meetings with the Russians, and they happened on the very eve of Obama taking action, and Obama's people were worried that Flynn would leak it to the Russians, which is what he did. And we don't know whether or not Flynn leaked the really important stuff, which is who was going to be sanctioned, and therefore, you know, these guys could move their money electronically before they were frozen by Treasury. So we'll, I guess, eventually find out about that. But in terms of leverage, because of Western Europe's dependence upon Russian gas through Gazprom, I believe the Dutch have built some LNG terminals and they get liquefied natural gas from Qatar. But the Qataris want to build a pipeline across Syria into the Mediterranean. But many people think that that's exactly why Putin's intervened in Syria, to prevent that from happening, because he doesn't want any alternatives to Western Europe dependent upon his gas. What do you know about alternative supplies that the Europeans might be looking at in order to be less dependent on the Russians?
Yeah, I think you know, I can't say a ton about what specific alternatives they are looking at, but I think that because there haven't been many credible proposals put on the table. But I was talking to Senator Chris Murphy, who is a Democrat, and he had an interesting point in relation to this, which was his whole argument. He's trying to put forward a Democratic vision of what foreign policy could look like, you know, as an alternative to Trump's vision right now. And he, one of his big arguments is that we need to de-emphasize the military relative to other economic and diplomatic levers that we have at our disposal. And one of his arguments was that there's so much talk about, you know, building up NATO as a deterrence to Russian aggression and doing various sorts of military buildups to deter America's enemies more broadly. And he was saying, why doesn't the U.S. invest more economically in helping Europe identify credible alternatives to Russian oil and Russian energy supplies? Because that would, you know, advance the goal of making Russia have less leverage with these countries than it does now. And part of his point is we don't really know the answers of what the best alternatives are, but we need to invest more in this if we really are serious about deterring Russian aggression, whether it's military aggression or cyber aggression. So I think that is something that could be done. But the U.S. government isn't currently working with Europe very much to do it. And more broadly than that, than just energy supplies, European governments, you see, are taking more safeguards in general to deter interference in their elections. So, for example, the Dutch election, which happened pretty recently, they actually counted all ballots by hand in order to try to protect themselves against any kind of cyber meddling. So we're seeing governments take more preventative measures as well, knowing that this is a reality of 21st century democracy.
Well, Yuri Friedman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Yuri Friedman, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers global affairs. He was previously the deputy managing editor at Foreign Policy, and his latest article at The Atlantic is France's Political Crisis Just Beginning? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the firing of five scientists on the EPA's Board of Scientific Counselors, with the likely purge of up to a dozen on the 18-member board.